Today's Teisho is on case one in the Hekigan Roku, the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case one is entitled Emperor Wu Asks Bodhidharma. Engo's introduction. Smoke over the hill indicates fire. Horns over the fence indicate an ox. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. One glance and you discern the smallest difference. Such quickness, however, is only too common among robed monks. When you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, then whatever situation you may find yourself in, you will enjoy perfect freedom in adversity and prosperity, in taking and giving. Now tell me, in fact, how will this sort of person behave? See Secho's complications. Main subject. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, not holiness. Who stands before me, the emperor said. Not knowing, said Bodhidharma. The emperor did not grasp his meaning. Thereupon, Bodhidharma crossed the river and went to the land of Wei. The emperor later spoke of this to Shiko, who said, do you in fact know who that person is? The emperor said, not knowing. Shiko said, this is the Bodhisattva Kanon, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal. The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, it's no good sending a messenger to fetch him back now. Even if all the people went, he would not return. Secho's verse, the holy teaching emptiness. What is the secret here? Again, who stands before me? Not knowing. Inevitably, the thorns and briars springing up. Secretly by night he crossed the river. All the people could not bring him back. Now, so many years gone by, still Bodhidharma fills your mind in vain. Stop thinking of him. A gentle breeze pervades the universe. The master looks around. Is the ancestor here? Yes, bring him to me, and he can wash my feet. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. I was reading something in the paper about animals' emotional life, and all of these scientists have been doing work on animal intelligence and animals' emotional life, And the article was just sort of summarizing all this research. And the research basically was saying that animals are much more intelligent than we imagine them to be, especially emotionally intelligent. It's true that dogs can't speak English, you know. But the article said, you know, dogs are so intelligent and their emotional life is so much like humans. This person who's an expert on dogs' intelligence said, dogs should have the rights, they should have rights under law as people. And most people in this community are quite convinced that that would be the way to go because... The dogs and the other animals they study are so very intelligent. The problem is, you know, that they aren't intelligent in our terms, right? So, you know, because we don't understand their intelligence, you know, we impose on them our standards of intelligence. So, if you say, you know, I've heard people say, you know, oh, what a dumb dog. You know, a dumb dog, it's almost a cliche. People don't always know what their animals are doing. And they reach the conclusion that the animal is unintelligent. But if you read this article, you become quite aware of how often we're the ones who are unintelligent. That dogs or cats and other animals are trying to communicate with us all the time, but we're not able to understand their communication. And, you know, the article really emphasized that these animals have a different way of being intelligent that's very closely tied into their emotions. You know, humans have a different way of being intelligent. You know, and our way of being intelligent is not always closely tied in with our emotions, actually. In fact, you know, a lot of intelligence in our culture, what we call intelligence in our culture, has to do with getting detached from our emotions. You know, so we often say, you know, there's reason, and then there's your emotions. And we can say, oh, you're not being a rational person, or you're not being a reasonable person. You're letting your emotions run away with you, see. So this is a very common way of thinking about our minds, right? And thinking about what it means to be intelligent. Intelligence means we put our emotions aside, and we just think, you know, pure thinking. And of course, in the realm of pure thinking, there's like language, communication, mathematics, all of these things, right? And this is what we call thinking. And consequently, you know, we're not able to see how intelligent dogs and cats really are. You know, maybe that's because our way of living is not really as intelligent as we thought. You know, in Japanese culture, they, and also in Chinese culture, you know, the words for mind and what we would call heart are not necessarily separate. You know, so when we recite the verses on the heart mind, you know, in Chinese, one of the words that appears in there is xin. And, you know, when you see xin translated, it can mean, it's often translated as mind, but it also has the sense of being heart. So, you know, in Chinese tradition, intelligence, you know, like mind, is not necessarily separated from emotional life, you know, heart. And the word xin is also in Japanese, but they have another word, kokoro, which is like a heart mind, more common everyday word than xin even. And so, you know, in these cultures, they don't necessarily distinguish, as we do, between, like, intelligence and emotion. Those two things are much more closely intertwined, and maybe, you know, maybe that's a good idea. You know, maybe we would be more intelligent if we didn't divide ourselves the way we do, and not just in the West now, but in the whole modern world, right? You know, we have, how should I put it? We don't really understand animals, I think, because we don't really understand ourselves. You know, we have very false, false image of who we are. And we have closed off in ourselves lots of different things to get where we are today. You know, I'm sure even if you try not to, the news of our president has leaked into your reality. So, you know, I myself get up almost every day, pretty much every day, and I meditate early in the morning, and then I undo all of that by looking at the newspaper. And you know, and I, there's always a being America right now, there's always a story about Trump in the paper, and it's always something totally outrageous. And I was reading the transcript of his conversations with the Prime Minister of Australia. And it's so clear that Mr. Trump is either, you know, he's either suffering from like dementia, or he has a very serious, he's seriously mentally ill. It's very clear, and it's not meant as an insult. It's pretty clear, you know. It's frightening sometimes. Sometimes you want to. I find myself laughing out loud. It's like a comedy routine, and then you know you remind yourself this is a very important person. To me, the thing, one question to ask is how did he get to be like this? And it's possible that these are like organic problems, like he's just gotten old and he's suffering from some kind of premature senility. But I think it's been his life habits have made him so unintelligent. And I also think that the other question to ask is, okay, how did he get like this, but how did we get him as our president? Because, you know, lots of people supported Mr. Trump. And it's worth asking how they could have made that decision. We can talk about joblessness, and we can talk about, rural people being left out of the political process and so on. But I definitely think the problem goes much deeper than that. You know, Mr. Trump is like an extreme case of life gone wrong, of a life, I think, like gone wrong. And his becoming president is also like an extreme case of many lives gone wrong, you know. People very, you know, in Buddhism, we don't think people are evil, right? That's kind of a term from Western religious thinking. You know, in Buddhism, the view is ignorance, right? So you know, in a Buddhist context, it doesn't really make any sense to say Mr. Trump is evil. There isn't really that concept in Buddhism, I would say. You know, what we can say is Mr. Trump is very ignorant, very confused person, and he's created mental habits that have made him, an astonishingly unintelligent person. A selfish, angry, constantly angry, intolerant, unintelligent person. And, you know, it doesn't make much sense in a Buddhist context to say his followers are evil and get really upset and angry at them, right? The Buddhist view would be that these are people who are confused. They're trapped, deeply trapped in confusion. Right? You know, it's very important to remind yourself of that, right? You know, as soon as you say somebody's evil, they become the bad guy, right? But you know, that doesn't allow us to respond with compassion, but also it doesn't give us any insight into how they got to be the way they are. And how, you know, basically, you know, we can learn from Mr. Trump a lot, you know, about how not to live our lives, you know, actually. You know, I have to say, you know, in my own family, there were many people who were very unhappy and destructive. You know, a lot of self-destructive people in my family. And, you know, seeing them as I grew up, it was very difficult to see so many people so unhappy, but it definitely helped me. Because, you know, I realized I don't want to be like this, you know. I don't want to be unhappy like this. I don't want to be destructive like this. And when I was lucky enough many, many, many years ago to run into Genki Roshi, you know, I started sitting and I realized this is a really wonderful way to avoid having that happen to me. So, you know, Mr. Trump is, we would say, from a Buddhist perspective, deeply, deeply in, you know, samsara. He's deeply, deeply confused. You know, samsara is an interesting word. You know, the root of samsara means to go around in a circle. See, and I think that's a wonderful insight into Mr. Trump and also the kind of people who are attracted to him, right? It's like, you know, Trump is angry all the time. He can't get out of his mental prison. And I think that's probably true for his followers as well. You know, people who are trapped in a way of seeing, and they just keep repeating the same unhappy way of being in the world. You know, it would be nice to think that Mr. Trump is unique, right? You know, when I was reading the transcript of his conversation with the Australian Prime Minister, I was so impressed by the Australian Prime Minister, who was absolutely polite and measured and careful and actually almost like helpful, right? As Trump was ranting on in this incoherent way, the Prime Minister was sort of like responding. Each response was clear, helpful, not angry, you know, at any rate, I wish that Mr. Trump were the only one on earth with these problems. But, you know, it's actually not so. You know, we're in a period right now in the world where there's like a lot of confusion, a lot of confusion. So I don't know if you follow Japanese politics, but, you know, Japan right now has a prime minister, right? Mr. Abe. Shinzo Abe, who is really, you know, many of his critics say he is a fascist, you know, very deeply authoritarian personality, and some of his advisors got into trouble for saying that they could learn from the Nazis. This was just recently. He has taken a lot of measures to curtail press freedom and to rewrite the Constitution to allow Japan to militarize, so on. So, you know, I was reading in the newspaper recently too that you might follow Indian politics, you know, and in India there's a man who people are very divided about, right? A leader who people are very divided about. We have some members of our group. We have a man who comes from Bhuvaneshwar every year to sit with us, who's a big fan of Mr. Modi's. And I have to tell you, Varish is his name, is a wonderful human being, and he likes Mr. Modi. So I don't talk about Mr. Modi with Varish, you know. But I definitely have Indian friends who are very worried about Mr. Modi. And you know, a couple of my Indian friends are Muslims, and they're very troubled by Mr. Modi's sort of putting we could say, very right-wing people into, you know, regional posts. You know, meanwhile, so you can go to Indonesia, you can go to Poland, you know, you can go to the Czech Republic, or, you know, this kind of thing is happening all over the world. And it's, you know, it's not just Trump, right? It would be nice if we could just say it was Trump, but it's not. It's sort of like there's a trend, or and you have to say, why is this happening? And I think it's because we don't know who we really are, right? And we don't really know how we should be living. You know, if you look at somebody like Mr. Trump, you know, he is, you know, if you look at him as a young man, he was a rich young man. His dad got him into a very good college. He went to college. He, you know, has an office. He has nice clothes. You know, he didn't start out living like a really terrible life. You know, he didn't steal. He wasn't a particularly vicious person. But, you know, after like living 50 years in a certain way, he has wound up being a very terrible person. And, you know, if you look at Mr. Abe's biography, you know, again, you know, Mr. Abe went to a good university in Japan. His parents are sort of like aristocratic. They're pretty rich, very privileged people. But again, you know, he doesn't. You wouldn't guess if you met him when he was 17 years old, that he was going to turn Japan into a military state again, right? And you know, Mr. Modi has many positive qualities. You know, actually, he's very dedicated to. He's a real patriot. He's not a crook. You know, which is so unusual in politics, right? He seems to be impeccably honest. He lives a very humble life. You know, so again, it's very difficult to see how did this guy get where he is, right? You know, how did he get? Because, you know, many people would say Mr. Modi is very confused too, and he didn't set out to be an evil person, right? He wasn't born evil, you know. He has gotten very confused, and we say, how did that happen? You know, because he's sort of lived a normal life. You know, Trump has sort of lived a normal life. Mr. Abe has sort of lived a normal life, you know. They didn't do anything terrible. They didn't set out to be monsters. They just got up every day and they went about their lives. But little by little, you know, they created a mental world which was really unhealthy for themselves and really unhealthy for the world around them. You know, I think that's because, you know, we in general don't understand ourselves very well. And the ordinary, everyday reality that people live in, which we take for granted and trust a lot, is not really a healthy reality. It's not really particularly good for us. You know, so I think it's possible just to be an ordinary, everyday person living in our reality and wind up as a very bad person. I really believe that. And I think many people assume that's not going to happen except for some, like, extraordinary thing making it happen, right? So it's like, look, if, you know, our world is okay, you know, basically just get up and live your life and, you know, you'll be okay. But, you know, actually these are people who got up and they lived their lives and they really aren't okay. You know, it takes little by little, day after day, they made decisions or they fell into mental habits that made them really bad people. And there was no, you know, it wasn't like Star Wars, you know, where there was a turning point and the die was cast. It was like little by little, every day, you know. You know, so I don't think we understand ourselves very well. And I think it's quite possible for us to live a sort of everyday, normal life and wind up being not very nice people. And so I think it's really important to cultivate ourselves, to practice some form of like cultivation. And there's many different forms of cultivation, you know. But I think, as you know, I'm very fond of meditation. And I deeply believe in its transformative power, you know. As I said, I try to meditate, you know, every day. I'm almost always successful, right? You know, if I don't do it in the morning, because I have some early appointment, I'll do it at night, and so on. And and meditation definitely helps me. I am quite convinced that I would be a much worse person without cultivating myself on the cushion. Yeah. And I think that people like Donald Trump, you know, if you met him in college, you know, he wouldn't have seemed so bad. You know, he would have been a reasonably kind of a vain, spoiled rich kid, you know. But he wouldn't have been a moral monster, you know. He wouldn't be what he is now, which is like somebody who's right on the edge of being a true monster. I think it was like one step at a time. He became the way he is, you know. It's also true that we can transform ourselves one step at a time too, in the other direction. You know, so when you read have the pleasure of seeing somebody like the Dalai Lama. You know, he's a very charismatic person, and he is really like a charming person. People who meet him for the first time want to hold his hand. You'll see pictures of people holding his hand, and he's holding their hands, and they've never met him. But he's definitely there's something about him that's very powerful for people. If you ever have the chance to meet him, he's really deeply warm and humane and sort of radiates compassion. You know, and just as we might think that a person like Trump has always been a rotten little SOB, which is not true, you know, you might think that the Dalai Lama has always been like the Dalai Lama. But you know, it's not true. You know, the Dalai Lama made himself the Dalai Lama. You know, and how did he do it? He did it by cultivating himself. You know, if you had taken Donald Trump and put him, when he was like 4 years old, in the Dalai Lama's chair, and you had kidnapped the Dalai Lama and brought him to New York, and sat him down in Queens or wherever it was that he was raised, you know, they might be just the, you know, different bodies would be just the way they are now, right? You know, so the Dalai Lama would be like Trump, almost insane, right? And talking about grabbing women's private parts, right? And Trump would be this benign, benevolent, loving, kindness, you know, bodhisattva, enlightened being. I really believe that. You know, it's definitely the case that somebody like Trump became Trump one day at a time. You know, I think that's true for Abe. I think that's true for Hitler. You know, I think Hitler didn't. I really don't believe Hitler started out as this. You know, like in the movies, there's like this motif in a lot of movies of like the demon baby, right? It's the devil's baby, and this little kid kills his mother and his nurse, and you know, he's got this. It's not like that, right? You know, Hitler was a little baby too. You know, he looked in his mother's eyes and he had love for his mother. That's true. I'm not justifying Hitler. But it's like one step after another, Hitler became Hitler. Yeah? And one sit after another, Dalai Lama became the Dalai Lama. You know, this is really, I think, how it is. So you know, in our Western way of thinking, you know, people are sort of the way they are all the time. By nature, we say, right? So somebody has a talent for playing the piano and somebody doesn't. Tenzin Gyatso had a talent for being the Dalai Lama, and Trump had a talent for being a spoiled brat. But it's really not like that. You know, Trump made himself one step at a time. The Dalai Lama made himself one step at a time. And, you know, we can be Trumps 20 years from now, or we can be like the Dalai Lama 20 years from now if we cultivate ourselves. You know, and I think it's very important to cultivate ourselves, because I think that if we don't cultivate ourselves, it's more likely we will wind up a kind of Trump-like person. And I do think that Americans are optimistic and generous in their outlook, but they underestimate how easy it is to become a person like Trump. And I think they don't appreciate the importance of cultivating their fundamental nature, as you're doing here this morning. You know, so you know, when you come in and sit down on the cushion, you know, might not be the best sit. You know, sometimes you come in and you sit down, and it's just like going to heaven. I hope you have sits like that, because I definitely do. And, you know, I'll sit down and it's just like, oh, that was fantastic. And I'll get up, maybe I have something on my mind that's been bothering me. I get up, I feel clean and clear. Sometimes I sit down and it's not like that. Maybe my legs hurt, or maybe it just doesn't, I can't get out of this emotional state at the end of one sitting period, you know. But little by little, day after day, you transform yourself into like the Dalai Lama, into an awakened person. And it's a big mistake to think that the Dalai Lama was anything special when he was born. You know, the Tibetan people believe in, a tulku system, right? The teachers are the reincarnation of their prior, from their prior lives, right? And that may or may not be true, but, you know, nevertheless, you know, I'm sure as a baby, Tenzin Gyatso was a selfish, self-absorbed, petulant, could be angry, jealous, all those things. You know, he's worked on himself, and he's, you know, you can do, the message is you can do it too. See, it's easy, you know, when the Dalai Lama comes to New York, 200,000 people show up to see him. But I wish 200,000 people realized that they could be like the Dalai Lama. It's okay to admire the Dalai Lama, more important to follow his example. And his example is cultivating the heart-mind, cultivating your heart-mind. So this koan is a wonderful, wonderful story. Bodhidharma is the Indian master who brought Zen to China. And this is a story about his encounter with the emperor. And it might actually have happened. This is in a lot of Zen literature. You know, Emperor Wu of Liang was actually a very good person. And he was doing what you could call good deeds. You know, so he was he was already a Buddhist. He had embraced Buddhism. In his court, there were many, many monks and nuns of distinction, mostly Indian. And the Chinese embarked on a very ambitious translation program over many centuries, engaged in translating all of these Indian scriptures, Sanskrit texts, into Chinese. And Emperor Wu was somebody making all this happen. He was building monasteries, he was building temples, he was building libraries. You know, he was doing all this good stuff. And somebody said to him, you know, a great meditation master from South India has come here, and it might be a good idea for you to meet him. This is like famous in Zen history. this is the story, or one of the accounts of their meeting each other. And let me read it again. Emperor Wu of Liang asked Bodhidharma, what is the first principle of the holy teachings? So this is a man who's built all of these temples, built all of these libraries, and he asked Bodhidharma, basically, you know, what is the essence of holiness? What is the essence of sacredness, or the essence of holiness according to your understanding of Buddhism? And Bodhidharma says, there is no holiness; it's emptiness. See, and the emperor doesn't get that, right? He understands holiness, but he doesn't understand emptiness. No, nobody's talked to him about emptiness. And he says to Bodhidharma, basically, it's like it could be interpreted as who are you? Who are you? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know who I am. I don't know who I am. Or I am not knowing. I am not knowing. So, you know, the emperor was not expecting this kind of a conversation. The koan actually says the emperor did not grasp his meaning. You know, he thought that Bodhidharma was going to introduce something, some kind of statement. Like, you know, if you do good deeds, you change your karma. Or if you that would be a good one. If you do good deeds, you're changing your karma. You know, if you help others, you're improving the chances of your next rebirth or something like that. And the emperor doesn't get it. And thereupon, the meeting is over. Right? This is like the most important encounter in the history of Zen. Bodhidharma meets the emperor of China. And instead of the emperor going, "My gosh, that's fantastic, I'll build you a temple," the emperor says, "I don't get it, I don't know what you're talking about," and Bodhidharma leaves. So after Bodhidharma leaves, the emperor later says to his to Shiko, who is a monk, who's a Buddhist monk. And Shiko is a Japanese version of a Chinese name. He says, "Do you know who that guy was that I interviewed, that I met with this afternoon? That Indian monk?" Shiko says to the emperor, "Who was that guy you met this afternoon? Who was that guy you met this afternoon?" And the emperor says, "He told me his name was Not Knowing. Not Knowing." And Shiko is stunned. Right. The emperor doesn't understand, but Shiko understands, and he says, "Oh, that's who he said he was? He is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. He is compassion itself, the bearer of the Buddha's heart seal." And the emperor is a good guy, right? He's full of regret. He says, "Oh my God, I didn't understand." The emperor was full of regret and wanted to send for Bodhidharma, but Shiko said, "You know, it's over now. You know, he's on his way somewhere else." You know. That's the encounter. So, you know, this is a wonderful story because, you know, the Emperor Wu of Liang is he's a good man. And he doesn't want to be Donald Trump. You know, he wants to be a good person. And he's cultivating himself in the way he thinks is appropriate. And there are many ways to cultivate yourself. You know, many ways. But, you know, the Zen way of cultivating yourself is emptiness, is mushin. So when we sit down on the cushion and we watch our breath, we enter a place that is absolutely formless. You know, you watch your breath. And at first, you know, you're just struggling with your breath, trying to focus on the breath because you have so many thoughts. And your body bothers you. Maybe your legs hurt. And it's hard to free yourself from your thoughts, right? You know, maybe you're agitated about something you're thinking, and it's hard to keep your body still. You might have noticed that if you're really agitated about something, it's hard to keep your body still. And when you're sitting, you may actually break your sit and put your hand on your head or something. So it's difficult to practice this at first. And when you follow the breath, eventually you'll get to a place as you follow the breath out where your mind is blank. And this is really important in Zen. This blankness is what we Zen people cultivate. You know, it's interesting. The Dalai Lama is from a different school of Zen. You know, it's called a Gelugpa school. Different school of Buddhism, really. And, you know, they also do emptiness meditation, but they wait many, many years. You know, my second teacher, Webb Roshi, had quite a few contacts with the Tibetan community, and he has quite a few friends who are like lamas. And they didn't know anything about Zen, and they were quite surprised that, you know, basically in the Zen tradition, we don't wait 15 or 20 years before we do emptiness meditation. But our method of cultivation is to go very quickly to that place. You know, so in the Zen tradition, we learn how to stabilize the mind by entering samadhi. And once we do that, we start working on emptiness meditation. You know, emptiness meditation, or we say mu, meditating on mu, or u, is the foundation of your practice. You know, no matter what koan you're working on, you know, you basically get up every day and you sit down on your cushion and you face that emptiness. And that is our way of cultivating ourselves. And you know, it's possible to say, you know, what good will that, you know, it's possible to say, what good will that do, just sitting on a cushion, get up and do something. But you know, most of the problems we have in the world are caused by people's mental habits. Truly. I don't know how it could be more obvious. You know, the world is going to turn into a giant terrarium, and we're all going to be having to move to the Himalayan mountains to avoid the water, right? And we all know it's a problem, but we can't do anything because of our mental habits. You know, and if India and China go to war over a road in Bhutan, a dirt road in Bhutan, and this is a big crisis going on right now, I hope you realize it's not about a dirt road, it's about people's mental habits, right? It's about ego, it's about fears. So I definitely think that the most important thing humans can do is cultivate awakened mind. And the way we do it is to sit down every day on the cushion and face that emptiness. And you know, it has been my experience that no matter what I bring to the cushion, the emptiness is deeply liberating. You know, the Heart Sutra, which we recite, says that there is no obstacle that emptiness cannot dissolve. You know, and that's definitely been the case for me. You know, a few years ago, well, actually about a decade ago, my brother had the misfortune of passing away. And it was like a week and a half before the March Sesshin. We used to have a March Sesshin. So, you know, it was very difficult for me to go to the March Sesshin. But, you know, I went to the Sesshin and I sat in emptiness. And, you know, naturally I encountered all the sadness. You know, I loved my brother. He was a wonderful guy. You know, all of those emotions were there, you know. And I definitely sat with a lot of sadness during the Sesshin. You know, but at the end of the Sesshin, you know, I felt, you know, just, I loved my brother. I was so sorry to see him go. And when he went, you know, I was heartbroken. But at the end of the Sesshin, I felt like spring had come to my heart. You know? You know, I've had other, you know, challenges like that in my life. But, you know, I think if you trust emptiness, you know, the Heart Sutra is telling the truth. There's really no obstacle it can't dissolve. You know, and my feeling is that we, you know, what we have done is to split ourselves into all of these different pieces. You know, we have an intellectual life, we have an emotional life, and because we have divided ourselves up in this crazy way, you know, it's very difficult to have like wholehearted response to anything. You know, most of our responses, if you observe them, are somewhat neurotic. Most of our responses to Trump is a deeply neurotic person, if he's not worse than that, right? But the average person is deeply neurotic, you know, actually. You know, we're very much split into, like, warring sides or conflicting, you know. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you confront that emptiness, you know, one of the things I think it does for you is to unify your life, unify yourself. Yeah, I think it restores heart and mind, body, heart, and mind unity. You know, and it's like we become whole by passing through that emptiness. See, and my feeling is it's very difficult to be truly understanding or truly compassionate when our responses are so deeply neurotic. You know, often when we respond to things, we're responding in a somewhat desperate way. You know, we're coming from a place of fear or self-doubt or, you know, many different possibilities. But it's very difficult to be truly compassionate when you're not able to be unified in yourself. And you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you enter emptiness, you know, what happens, it may take a while, but what happens is that body, mind, and heart are unified. And, you know, this is incredibly revitalizing. And it allows us to be genuinely compassionate in our reactions to others because we're not coming from a place of fear or attachment. So this is what, you know, Shinko meant. You know, when the emperor met Bodhidharma, he was familiar with certain ways of cultivating himself, right? The emperor was not just a Trump, right? He wanted to be a good man. He wanted to be an awakened person. And he was cultivating himself in the ways he knew how, but he encountered this Zen master, Bodhidharma, and asked Bodhidharma, how do I become an excellent person? What kind of holiness should I be seeking? And Bodhidharma said, our way is not to cultivate holiness. Our way is to cultivate emptiness. You know, and the emperor didn't understand. You know, but later when he talked to one of his monks, the monk said, who was that guy? And the emperor said, he said, cultivate emptiness. He said, I don't know who I am. The monk was deeply moved, and he said, that person is an embodiment of Avalokiteshvara, of the Bodhisattva of compassion. You know? So, you know, the Bodhisattva of compassion walked out the door of the emperor's palace and went over to Shaolin, what would later become Shaolin Temple. But you know, it's actually never too late to cultivate yourself. You know, I was on the phone last night to my friend John Sunson, who is 80 years old. He's 80 years old, and I have to say, you know, he's been practicing Zen for a long time, and he has many obstacles, but he's practicing wholeheartedly. And he has become he's a wonderful human being. And I think his Zen practice has helped him to make that transformation. You know, I have to say, my friend John has not had Daikensho. That hasn't happened for him yet. But, you know, there's still time to wake up. And he's working really hard, very inspiring. So, you know, thank you so much for coming today and practicing this beautiful way of Zen. Please don't be a Trump. Yes. Please cultivate your Buddha nature by facing emptiness.